Emma did not repent her condescension in going to the Coles. The visit afforded her many pleasant recollections the next day, and all that she might be supposed to have lost. I'm Ellen.
And I'm Harriet, and this is Reading Jane Austen, coming back after a long break because I got all behind with the editing.
This week, we're looking at chapters 27 to 31 of Emma, and it's your turn to go first with a 100-word summary.
Okay. Emma and Harriet go shopping. They're invited to see Jane's new piano, along with Mrs. Weston and Frank. Frank wants a ball. Randall's is too small, so they decide to have it at the Crown. But Frank's called back to Enscombe as his aunt is unwell. When taking leave of Emma, she's sure he was about to declare his love before being interrupted. She decides she's a bit in love with him, but not too much. She thinks that he and Harriet might get together. Harriet is agitated about Mr. Elton's marriage, and Emma gives her a lecture about duty. So that sort of came together as a whole bunch of independent sentences. It doesn't really flow very well, but I tried to get what I think are the main points. So how about yours?
Harriet tells Emma that Mr. Martin dined with the Coxes. As a distraction, they go to Ford's together, and Miss Bates invites them to see the new piano. Miss Bates has a conversation with Mr. Knightley through the window, which everyone can hear. Prompted by Frank, the Westons plan a ball, but his aunt's illness means Frank has to return to Enscombe. He seemed to want to say something to Emma before he left. Emma feels she is somewhat in love with him, but knows she will never leave her father. She speculates on a match between Frank and Harriet.
Okay, so we did cover some different points in the chapters.
Yes.
Which is good.
Yes.
So you said you had something general you wanted to say about the chapters.
Yes, this brought me back to something I said when we were reading Mansfield Park about the tremendous amount of information that Jane Austen gets into what seems on the surface like a really simple narrative.
Mm.
And I just wonder, is this one of the things that makes her such a quality writer, that she tells you so much in what sounds like a perfectly simple narrative told from one person's point of view?
Mm.
Anyway, I found this was particularly significant in these chapters. That was just the general thing I wanted to say.
At the start of chapter 27, we have this little bit where Emma starts to feel guilty about what she said to Frank Churchill about Jane Fairfax. And that is just so believable.
You say something
and then at 3 a.m. you wake up and think, I should never have said that.
Yes, and she sort of continually through these chapters is enticing her to keep going with it. She wants to stop.
Yeah.
And continually he's pulling her along. Right at the beginning of that chapter is the little piece Harriet says about what Miss Cox said to her about Mr. Martin coming to dinner with them. And we've got Emma thinking, oh, there are real divisions in society and people should stay in them.
Mm.
Emma has finally accepted the Coles. Mm. But then who visits the Coles? Mr. Cox. Who does Mr. Cox have to dinner? Mr. Martin. And so you've got this long entwined group of people who visit one another.
Mm.
And that takes us back to Weber's description of how status is defined. And he says status is defined by the people you will have dinner with, perhaps it's the ones you'll invite to dinner, and the people that you're prepared to marry.
Mm.
And I want to bring up the people you're prepared to marry a bit later.
The next thing we have is the lovely scene of Harriet and Emma in Ford's.
Thing that comes through is really the dependence Harriet is having on Emma and Emma's acceptance of it.
Mm. But then Mrs. Weston and Frank turn up, and this is one of those scenes where the dialogue reads completely differently the second time you read it from the first time, because everything Frank says, the way he manipulates his way into convincing Mrs. Weston that she has to call on the Bateses that morning, and
yes,
then pretending that he doesn't want to go with her, but setting it up so that she will insist that he goes with her.
Yes.
He's really very good at manipulating people.
Yes.
The other thing that really struck me in this chapter is Miss Bates turns up and has two incredibly long monologues. Yeah. And like I said before, previously my eyes have kind of glazed over when I read her monologues.
Yeah.
This time I read them much more closely. They're actually not monologues. She's talking to Mrs. Ford and says, "I hear you have a charming collection of new ribbons from town. Jane came back delighted yesterday. Thank you. The gloves do very well." Mrs. Ford has obviously said something in there and Jane Austen has just cut it out.
Yes.
So I thought I'd noticed this myself for the first time. But then when I was rereading John Mullen, I discovered he said exactly the same thing in his chapter about how experimental a novelist was Jane Austen. He says that in his standard work on speech and fiction, Norman Page talks of the convention much favoured by Jane Austen, whereby the novelist is permitted to conflate into a single speech what must probably be supposed to have been uttered as several separate speeches. And John Mullen says, "In fact, this convention seems to have been invented by Austen. At one extreme, it is used for the incessant flow of Miss Bates. Other people must sometimes be speaking during her unstoppable monologues, but their interventions or responses are excised." And then he reads out a section of her talk at the ball at the Crown. And then he goes on to say, "Other people are saying things, but their words are simply smothered. The contraction of time is part of the effect, as if the dialogue were boiling down the effects of listening to this character. Even better, if we were to be able to hear what Jane Fairfax or Frank Churchill were saying, we might be able to detect their awkwardness." So, as I said, I thought I was really clever to have noticed this time, and I had just completely forgotten John Mullen had said it. And, of course, I hadn't realised just how much of an innovation this was that Jane Austen had done.
No, I'd never really noticed that before. Mm. In fact, I've always quite enjoyed Miss Bates's accounts because of the sort of detail of life that they give.
Again, reading them properly for the first time, I did enjoy the stream of consciousness. Every sentence connects with the next sentence.
Yes.
Yet you end up in such
somewhere
a
quite different.
Yes. Quite different. And then, of course, when Miss Bates says, "Now, what was I talking about?" And it says, "Emma wondered on what of all the medley she would fix." It's just beautiful. Chapter 28 is the chapter set in the Bates' rooms with everyone coming up to see and listen to the new piano.
Yes.
When they arrive there, Frank Churchill is at a table near Mrs. Bates, most deedily occupied about her spectacles.
I love deedily.
And Jane Fairfax is standing with her back to them, intent on her pianoforte. John Mullen thinks they have definitely been talking and possibly embracing, because it talks about how Jane is at the piano and Frank has only just finished the spectacles.
Yes, and also, of course, Mrs. Bates hasn't got her spectacles, so she's sitting there not hearing or seeing anything.
Yeah.
Second read, you know, you have so much thinking to do. But first read through, you've got a lot of thinking.
Yeah.
You're trying to match this with what Emma had to say about Jane caring about Mr. Dixon.
Yeah.
And you get that little hint that she has this sort of smile that's sort of suppressed, which again, in the second reading, you think, oh, she is really thrilled that Frank's given it to her.
Yes.
She's not totally embarrassed by the gift.
Yeah. Emma is actually right when she says she had not yet possessed the instrument long enough to touch it without emotion. She must reason herself into the power of performance, and Emma could not but pity such feelings, whatever their origin, and could not but resolve never to expose them to her neighbour again. So much is packed into that, both first and second time, because Emma is still seeing that Jane is in a heightened emotional state and it's connected with the piano. But then you get all that, I think, really quite horrible stuff where Frank is saying all these things about Ireland and Colonel Campbell sending very explicit instructions about the piano. And he's obviously told Jane what Emma said last night. He's teasing Emma and trying to make her laugh. And she's finding it amusing, but she's also finding it progressively more uncomfortable, which is fairly reprehensible on his part, but I think it's just mean to Jane.
You know, to be able to tease Jane with these stories that Emma is making up about her, and with Jane, who is very reserved and very private.
Yes.
It must be dreadful for her to know all these stories, and they have so little time together that she probably can't really rein him in properly.
Yeah. It does say that Emma wished he would be less pointed, yet could not help being amused.
With Emma, she has so little in her life of this kind of having sort of fun with someone her own age, whereas it's nothing to Frank. In spite of Mrs. Churchill, Frank has managed to spend quite a bit of time with girls within his flirting age.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens in this scene is Mr. Knightley arrives and Miss Bates talking to him out the window. And Mr. Knightley shows that in spite of sometimes seeming a bit older and ponderous and boring, he does show his sense of humour in this scene when he says, "For I suppose Miss Woodhouse and Mr. Frank Churchill are hearing everything that passes," and raising his voice still more, "I do not see why Miss Fairfax should not be mentioned too. I think Miss Fairfax dances very well. And Mrs. Weston is the very best country dance player without exception in England. Now, if your friends have any gratitude, they will say something pretty loud about you and me in return, but I cannot stay to hear it."
I mean, that is the way Mr. Knightley goes on.
Yeah.
And he's not sort of kowtowing to Miss Bates.
No.
He's just responding to her in a way that isn't being indulgent. "Oh, this is Miss Bates going on. Oh, yes, put up with it."
Mm.
It's, "This is Miss Bates going on. Let's respond to her as another adult."
Yes.
He is not, in fact, condescending. He's not treating her, say, the way they treat Mr. Woodhouse.
Chapter 29 is all about where can they have the ball, the discussions about that.
Except there's the other thing in that chapter, which is an extra picture of Mr. Woodhouse. I might say here, you know, I have my backstory of that Mr. Woodhouse was always very protected, never allowed to go anywhere or do anything. And he says he's never been to the Crown in his life.
Yeah.
And the Crown is the place where all the men of his standing are always meeting. So he must not be somebody who had a more normal life and is now becoming more senile.
Mm. Another one of these bits about Mr. Woodhouse and Emma's relationship that they're sown throughout the book, but you need to be attentive to see them, or at least I missed them before, which is when Emma says, "Don't you think it's an improvement to have it at the Crown?" She was obliged to repeat and explain it before it was fully comprehended. And then, being quite new, further representations were necessary to make it acceptable. So again, we get another bit about Mr. Woodhouse needs things explained carefully, and Emma always does.
Yes, so she's using this perfectly good stuff about the ball, but we get this extra stuff on Mr. Woodhouse.
And of course, she also builds up Mr. and Mrs. Weston because she's concerned about one thing and he's concerned about another thing, and then they both change their minds.
Yes, and of course, the other thing that comes up in that chapter is showing how inept Frank Churchill is at dealing with Mr. Woodhouse and how he's so sure he knows how to do it. But the others so politely edge him aside.
Yeah.
Nobody says, "Stop it, Frank."
Mm. And the chapter finishes with the insight that it's clear Mr. and Mrs. Weston have been talking about Frank and Emma when she overhears him saying to Mrs. Weston, "He has asked her, my dear. That's right, I knew he would."
And this is another thing that makes it all fun for Emma, where you've got her close friends thinking about her.
Yeah.
And she likes that.
Because that's one of the reasons she wants the ball in the first place. Not just because she wants to dance, but because she wants people to see her dancing with Frank.
Yes. And also that she doubts if Jane Fairfax dances better than she does.
And that's actually one in the next chapter, chapter 30. Jane is really excited about the ball. Jane says, "Oh, Miss Woodhouse, I hope nothing may happen to prevent the ball. What a disappointment it would be. I do look forward to it, I own, with very great pleasure." That is probably the first excited, unreserved utterance we've had from Jane in the entire book.
A personal one. All the time, Emma has been trying to get into some sort of personal relationship with Jane, where she says what she thinks and Jane says what she thinks.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, she's got with Harriet, but Harriet isn't much good at pulling her thoughts out.
Mm.
Whereas what she's always wanted, she knows Jane is clever enough to meet her on an equality when they talk about feelings and people and so on.
On an equality that the only two people in her life she's ever had she can talk to like that are Mr. Knightley and Mrs. Weston, Miss Taylor.
Yes.
Other than that, everyone else Emma can't talk to in that way.
Well, that's why Frank has been so lovely. Yeah. She leaps at Frank to try her ideas out on. Whereas if she tells them to Harriet, Harriet just says, oh, yes, yes, that sounds so true.
Mm. When the Churchills write back to Frank and say, no, you do have to come home now because Mrs. Churchill is ill. And then Frank comes to take leave of Emma and he's about to tell her something. And she thinks
that is beautiful, that little scene.
And again, it's so obvious when you read it the second time because they've just been talking about the Bateses. And then he says, in short, perhaps Miss Woodhouse, I think you can hardly be quite without suspicion. And that's just after he's said that he went to see the Bateses first. So it's so obvious that that's why his train of thought is, you must have suspected there's something between me and Jane.
Yes.
And Emma just totally misses it.
Well, because she's geared herself up, and the Westons have, to think that Frank is attracted by her.
Mm.
And up to a point he is. It's just that he's engaged to Jane.
Yeah. Well, he thinks he's just flirting with Emma.
But he doesn't care that it's going to bother Jane to see him doing this.
Yeah. Chapter 31 really has two parts to it, two things that happen in it. The first is Emma thinking about how she's not really all that much in love with Frank. He's more in love with her, and she's going to have to make sure she doesn't encourage him when he comes back, which, by the way, she totally fails to do when he does come back.
I love that whole passage. I almost put it for my favourite sentence, except it went on and on and on. No, I think it's just charming. Emma there making up the letters they're going to write to one another, these interesting scenes they're going to have, and then noticing, I've always said no to him, but she's inventing all these lovely things for Frank to say about her. It's so light-hearted somehow, that bit.
Mm.
And her conviction that there's no way she'd say yes.
And this is the first time where she starts to think maybe Frank and Harriet would work together. But then, again, it's the way Emma structures and flows so well. You have Emma thinking about Frank and herself. Then you have her thinking about Frank and Harriet. And that just segues so beautifully into the fact that Harriet is really stressed out over the whole Mr. Elton getting married thing.
Yes.
And Emma is actually starting to get quite irritated by it. She says that she felt she could not do too much for her, that Harriet had a right to all her ingenuity and all her patience, but it was heavy work to be forever convincing without producing any effect, forever agreed to without being able to make their opinions the same.
Well, she's just finding out that Harriet is less biddable than her father. She can usually persuade her father to accept things, but Harriet has taken the Mr. Elton thing more seriously.
Yeah. But then she finally gets so frustrated with it that she tries to guilt trip Harriet into stopping carrying on when she says, you're allowing yourself to be so occupied and so unhappy about Mr. Elton's marrying, Harriet, is the strongest reproach you can make me. You could not give me a greater reproof for the mistake I fell into. It was all my doing, I know. But then she says this thing that I found on this reading is so, so reminiscent of Eleanor talking to Marianne when she says, I would wish it to be done for the sake of what is more important than my comfort, a habit of self-command in you, a consideration of what is your duty, an attention to propriety, an endeavour to avoid the suspicions of others, to save your health and credit and restore your tranquillity. These are the motives which I have been pressing on you. They are very important, and sorry I am that you cannot feel them sufficiently to act upon them. My being saved from pain is a very secondary consideration. I want you to save yourself from greater pain. Perhaps I may sometimes have felt that Harriet would not forget what was due, or rather what would be kind by me. She is still kind of guilt-tripping her, but everything she says there, I was going to do a comparison and I forgot, but I so feel Eleanor could have said that to Marianne in those exact words.
Yes, I suppose it's the, what do they call it in Mansfield Park? Is it the principles they have to live by?
Yeah.
And this is Emma who has been taught these principles and internalised them.
Yeah.
And up to a point, I mean, we do see her in some ways living by these broad principles that underlie what Fanny believes, what Eleanor believes.
Mm.
These principles, anyway, that Sir Thomas felt that Julia and Maria had not been fully inculcated in, She is trying to remind Harriet of them, because no doubt Harriet has also heard about them at Mrs. Goddard's. Mm. But did she internalise it? Yeah. Probably not much.
Yes. Mm. And it does say that this was what made Harriet try and get a bit more control over herself, which made it nice for Emma as well.
Yes.
That was where those chapters finished. Did you have anything else to say about them?
Not really, no.
Okay, favourite sentence. What was yours?
My favourite one comes from Mr. Woodhouse when he's responding to Frank Churchill, talking about how people go behind the curtains and open the windows. And I just love it because it's Mr. Woodhouse. He's picked up certain ways you talk about the world. He's being, in his own mind, quite an adult man of the world talking. And he says, "Bless me, I never could have supposed it, but I live out of the world and am often astonished at what I hear." What I was interested in was him thinking of the world and how he's living out of the world and this wide, dreadful world where people go to the Crown and so on, that he's never been part of it, and he's being horrified when people like Frank Churchill tell him about it.
Mm. Well, the one I had, they've come to the Crown and they're looking at it, and Mrs. Weston is concerned about it all being dirty, and Mr. Weston says it's all fine, and it says, "The ladies here probably exchanged looks," which meant men never know when things are dirty or not. "And the gentleman perhaps thought each to himself, women will have their little nonsense and needless cares." In a modern day sitcom, you could have exactly the same thing.
Yes.
It's maybe not a universal truth, but it's certainly a universal joke.
Yes.
The character we're talking about this episode is Harriet Smith. Up until this reading of the book, I've always found her a really irritating character, because I've just found her uninteresting and stupid. But I think this time through, I'm seeing that that's not really fair. And one thing that actually struck me just today when I was preparing for this is there are three, to different degrees, unintelligent people in this book. There's Mr. Woodhouse, there's Miss Bates, and there's Harriet.
I think actually you should put them in different order. They should be Miss Bates and then possibly Harriet and then Mr. Woodhouse.
But one thing that did strike me about it is they are not ridiculed. They are not ridiculed in the way Mr. Collins is ridiculed. They are not ridiculed in the way that John Dashwood is sometimes ridiculed. They are treated with sympathy by the narrator. The narrator makes it very clear, as we saw in this chapter, that Emma is sometimes irritated by Harriet. But I do think that's quite significant in Emma, that these three unintelligent characters are treated not as figures to be ridiculed. We can laugh at them at times, but it's always a kindly laugh. And with Harriet's lack of intelligence, and I think it's undeniable, she is not a very bright person, but the movie adaptations that portray her as monumentally stupid, I find very irritating. What I like are the ones that just show her as incredibly suggestible, so dependent on Emma. And in the chapters we've read this time, that really funny scene in Ford's, Harriet's trying to do her shopping and doesn't know what, and it says in the end that Emma is trying with the force of her own mind to convince her that if she wanted plain muslin, it was of no use to look at figured, and that a blue ribbon, be it ever so beautiful, would still never match her yellow pattern. And then later on, the bit where Harriet says, "Send it to Mrs. Goddard's." "No, send it to Hartfield." "No, maybe it'd be better at Mrs. Goddard's." And Emma says, "I think you should not give another half second to the subject. To Hartfield, if you please, Mrs. Ford." "Aye, that will be much best," said Harriet, quite satisfied. "I should not at all like to have it sent to Mrs. Goddard's."
The thing for me that this is almost suggesting is how very nice Mrs. Goddard has been. I mean, that is the behaviour of somebody who's basically indulged.
Mm.
She's like a much younger teenager. Rather than being 17, she's behaving more like a 13 or 14-year-old. And it's the parent who's prepared to stand there and say, "Okay, you know, make up your mind. Yes, that's what you want." "No, that'd be foolish."
And this also made me think, you know, back when we were talking about the Martins and Mrs. Martin, I think Mrs. Martin will train Harriet up.
Yes.
Towards the end, Mr. Knightley says that he's come to see Harriet as an artless, amiable girl with very good notions, very seriously good principles, and placing her happiness in the affections and utility of domestic life.
Actually, that's bringing up the good principles,
yeah,
which we had demonstrated to us, yeah, in that chapter we were just talking about,
mm,
when Emma appeals to her principles,
mm,
to get her to control her feelings about, yeah, Mr. Elton.
Yeah. So she's not, well, maybe yes, you can say she's monumentally stupid, but that is not the be-all and end-all of her character. We get a much more subtle presentation than I think I initially took from the book.
Yes.
Another thing, when she tells Emma that she's fallen in love with Mr. Knightley, and Emma asks if you have any idea of him returning your affections. Yes, replied Harriet, modestly but not fearfully. I must say that I have. We're suddenly seeing a much more confident Harriet who has developed her own opinions.
For some reason, that's a tiny scene that has stuck in my memory for a long, long time. Just that description of Harriet modestly mentioning this herself with this confidence.
Yes.
And somehow you don't quite feel you're fooling yourself, do you?
Well, the thing is, what we've seen this time is with Mr. Elton, you said it yourself, everything about Mr. Elton, Emma has fed to Harriet.
Yes.
In this case, she has started out with her misunderstanding of what Emma was saying and thinking it might be possible, but then she has gathered her own evidence of her own interactions with Mr. Knightley, which is why she is now confidently saying, I do have some evidence that he cares for me. And that's really beautiful. Then there's the less beautiful bit where she says, I hope I know better now than to care for Mr. Martin or to be supposed of it. Emma just dumps down on it completely in her own head, where she says that Harriet was less humble, had fewer scruples than formerly. Her inferiority, whether of mind or situation, seemed little felt. And I just thought, until this scene, have we seen real evidence throughout the book of Harriet becoming more confident, more assertive, more sure of herself? I'm not sure we have.
I'm trying to think, say, her dependence on Miss Nash, but she's still running to Miss Nash at the Coles dinner party.
Yeah.
But I wonder, does Miss Nash turn up in the book after that point?
Mm.
Because, you know, that's where you've got Harriet under the sort of silliness influence of the teachers at the school.
Mm. But it does seem that Harriet at this stage of the book is more confident, more self-assertive, possibly more vain, has less of a sense of inferiority than the Harriet at the start of the book had. And I know from reading commentaries, some of the film adaptations of the book have tried to bring that out. In particular, the most recent version of Emma from 2020, the director said that at the end of the film, Harriet is much more willing to give orders to servants than she was at the start of the film.
Well, you can see she must have had a lot of experience in living in that particular style.
Yeah.
And again, that may well be why she feels more confident in marrying Mr. Knightley. She spent a lot of time living at Hartfield. She's seen how Emma treats the servants. It's been suggested by Emma that she speaks to them in certain ways. She knows how such a household operates. Whereas even when she was first suggesting that she might marry Mr. Elton, she really didn't have all that much knowledge of how a gentleman's household would work. She'd been in a school,
yeah,
but not in a household. But by the time she's starting to think about Mr. Knightley, she's spent, you know, months staying a lot of the time at Hartfield,
yeah,
you know, learning to be a daughter of the house who presumably has noticed how to be a lady of the house.
And the other thing, of course, is that she's had lots of one-on-one conversations with Mr. Knightley.
Yes.
Then when she does finally get engaged to Mr. Martin, Mr. Martin really doesn't waste any time. Basically, there was being thrown together at Astley's when,
yes,
they got separated, and then the next day he proposes. Emma talks about how could Harriet be in love with three men in the course of a year. But I think it goes with what you were saying earlier, that Emma never really understood how much Harriet did in fact care for Mr. Martin. He was still there all the time, which is why after 2 days she was willing to accept his proposal.
Well, I mean, she was still terribly embarrassed at running into him in Ford's and people like the Miss Coxes are talking about
him.
Yes, and she also probably believes a lot more in Mr. Martin's affection for her because he's the one who did do nice things to her.
Yeah, and she was right.
Yes.
There is one other thing I want to say about Harriet. I know you're going to be talking about illegitimacy in the historical section, but we had a comment on our Facebook page from Julie asking if we'd heard of the suggestion that Harriet's mother was Miss Bates. We never actually hear anything about Harriet's mother. We learn that her father was a tradesman. Nothing is ever said of her mother. I guess I've kind of assumed that her mother probably died in childbirth or very soon after. But in this Facebook post, Julie did link to an article in Persuasions, the Jasna Journal, as long ago as 1985. It's by Edith Lank and it's called The Word Was Blunder, Who Was Harriet Smith's Mother? And this article comments on the fact that Miss Bates' Christian name is Hattie, which could be short for Harriet, and everywhere in Jane Austen, the firstborn daughter takes the mother's name, which is true, and says that that must be significant. And she does point out that the chronology is such that Miss Bates could have been away from Highbury when Harriet Smith was born because Harriet Smith was born at about the time Jane Fairfax's mother died. And so you read this and you think, I'm meant to be taking all this seriously. But then she finishes up by saying, many a scholar has argued from a complete lack of evidence that such universal silence on the matter clearly strengthens my thesis. And mannerly Jane Fairfax, who knows so well how to keep a secret, never once speaks a single word to Harriet Smith. Of course, as Frank Churchill reminds us, sometimes one conjectures right and sometimes one conjectures wrong. There is always the possibility that Hetty was meant as a diminutive for Henrietta. Enough, as Emma says reassuringly and not quite convincingly, all in a joke, a mere joke among ourselves. So I think this article is written very much tongue-in-cheek. It is true that you could say that it's theoretically possible.
The idea is that Harriet's tradesman's father had an affair with Miss Bates at the time that Jane Fairfax's mother was dying.
Yes, I think so. What she says is the chronology, carefully constructed as always by Jane Austen, easily allows for a visit by the secretly pregnant Miss Bates to her dying sister, for Jane Fairfax was 3 years old when her mother died and is not quite 3 years older than Harriet Smith. The child is born far from Highbury, and Lieutenant Fairfax's widow, the only witness, dies soon after. And as old Mrs. Bates complains, nobody tells her anything. So once I got to the end, I found this a delightful article to read.
Yes.
Helena Kelly, in her book Jane Austen, The Secret Radical, she also starts from the fact that Miss Bates is called Hetty, but she says this means that Harriet Smith could be Jane Fairfax's mother's daughter. I think what Helena Kelly is saying is that Jane Fairfax was born, her father dies, then her mother has a relationship with a tradesman and is pregnant. She dies in childbirth, and this is the second-born daughter. She's given the name Harriet. She's given over to her father. And again, that is an awful lot of building on one possible similarity in name, which, as Edith Lank pointed out, Hetty could just as easily be short for Henrietta.
In the historical piece today, I'm going to be talking about how illegitimacy was regarded in the social circle Jane Austen wrote about. As we need continually to remind ourselves, the people Jane Austen wrote about were by and large affected by life's disasters a good deal less than those in the classes below them, and that this applied to illegitimacy as well as to so much else. The illegitimate children whose social position I'll be considering here were lucky when compared, for example, to the children of the thousands of servant girls who were each year seduced and then abandoned by their employers or by their employers' friends and relations. And this would have included friends of all the sort of Jane Austen people we're talking about. Nevertheless, it looks as if Harriet was one of the lucky ones among this group. The debates about whether Harriet is an acceptable wife for Mr. Elton have taken me back to the sociologist Max Weber's argument that status was defined by conceptions of commensality and connubium. By commensality, he meant the people that eat at the same table. It comes from mensa, the table. And in my last historical piece, I talked about how the Coles dinner party gives an insight into the social structure of Highbury, how the Coles drew a status line between those who must be invited to sit at the table for actual dinner, those who could be asked to come in and drink tea with their guests after the meal was finished, and all the rest of Highbury.
Who weren't invited.
Who weren't invited, yes. But I think we can see that in the social world of Highbury, the boundaries set up by the other aspect, connubium, the group of people who consider it appropriate to marry one another, are a good deal stricter than those for commensality. Mr. Elton is quite prepared to sit down at table with Harriet, but he differs strongly from Emma on whether they're in the same group when it comes to marriage. Emma, we gather, doesn't consider illegitimacy a bar to this marriage.
Well, isn't that because she's got this idea in her head that Harriet's father is a gentleman, not someone of a lower class?
And that was just what I was going to read out when she's arguing with Mr. Knightley. As to the circumstances of her birth, though in a legal sense she may be called nobody, it will not hold in common sense. She is not to pay for the offence of others.
Which is fair enough.
And which a lot of people believed, though an awful lot more didn't. She is not to pay for the offence of others by being held below the level of those with whom she is brought up. There can scarcely be a doubt that her father is a gentleman, and a gentleman of fortune. Her allowance is very liberal. Nothing has ever been grudged for her improvement or comfort. As I've said before, I don't think we can really trust Emma's interpretations of social rules. She's worked out what she thinks are the rules governing society, but living in such a restricted circle, she's had very little opportunity to see them tested in real life. And at first she claims that Harriet's social position comes from her own friendship with Emma, and that she must therefore marry a man who would be invited to dine at the same table with Emma, which, of course, includes Mr. Elton, but excludes Mr. Martin.
Mm.
This passage also suggests that she has had romantic fantasies about Harriet's actual parents, and when it's revealed that Harriet's father was only a well-off tradesman, she is appalled at the connection she had been preparing for Mr. Knightley or for the Churchills or even for Mr. Elton, the stain of illegitimacy, unbleached by nobility or wealth, would have been a stain indeed. But was it just the illegitimacy that was the problem? If Harriet's fortune had been larger, or if she'd been acknowledged by her father, would things have been different, even if he was a tradesman? To answer this question, I've tried to fit the way Jane Austen suggests illegitimacy was regarded with other little scraps about illegitimate children that I've picked up from various sources. My impression, though I have to admit it's influenced by Victorian examples rather more than Regency ones, is that it was more or less up to the parents of the illegitimate child to decide whether or not that child would be acknowledged as a relation by the wider family. Whether, as in Harriet's case, it would be given an income for life but not acknowledged, or it would be acknowledged and their friends and acquaintances would be expected to acknowledge the child as more or less an equal. It is possible to see how wide the opportunities could be, and I've just selected one or two more or less contemporary cases that seemed to go along with what Harriet's position was. In the first place, you can compare her with Charles Dickens's father, who was born probably in about the same time as Harriet. He was the son of a servant in a very grand house, but it's presumed by Dickens's biographers the servant was made pregnant by an even more distinguished guest at the house. Mm-hmm. Like Harriet's father, Dickens's grandfather never acknowledged the Dickens family as his relatives, but it's presumed because he had plenty of power, he got him a job in the Navy office where he didn't have to do much at all, mm-hmm. and a nice little income came in. Mm-hmm. But Dickens and his brothers and sister were never invited to meet their grandfather in any way. But it was not necessarily like this. There is the example of a different outcome revealed in the painting called Portrait of Dido Elizabeth Bell and Lady Elizabeth Murray. And a contributor to the Persuasions Journal has argued that this shows the relationship of the Earl's daughter and her illegitimate cousin, is similar to that of Fanny and the Bertram sisters. On the other hand, very recently, I watched an episode of the TV program, Who Do You Think You Are?, which also seemed pertinent to this. It was about an English actress who discovered that she had ancestors who'd served in the East India Company's army in the 1790s and 1800s. And one of these was serving in North India and had a relationship with an Indian woman from that district that they haven't been able to find anything much about. But together they had a little girl, and this little girl was called Harriet too. And then in 1810, when the little girl was about 3 years old, the father died. And when his mother, back in England, heard, which was about 6 months later because it took that long for a letter to get from India back to England, she immediately made arrangements for the little girl to be taken from her mother and brought back to the UK.
Which is kind of appalling.
Oh, absolutely dreadful. It must have been pretty traumatic for the little girl, but she seems to have been treated as a full member of the family by her grandmother and other relations. In her teens, she was sent to a boarding school in Bristol, where she was enrolled under the family name, and the great aunt left her £800 in her will. When she was about 25 and still unmarried, like Jane Austen's aunt a generation earlier, she joined what was known as the fishing fleet of girls going out to India to find a husband. Her first husband, a naval officer, died, but an East India Company officer followed her back to England and married her, and then they then went back to India and had a string of children.
The poor mother to have this child just taken away from her.
We don't know anything about what happened to the mother, and of course we don't know anything about what happened to Harriet's mother. We know what the father did, that he cared about Harriet.
Yeah. Well, I suppose she might have died in childbirth. She might have died some years later before Harriet was sent to school. Or she might have brought up Harriet and then had Harriet ripped from her arms to be sent to school.
Yeah, or she was given some money when she had the baby, then the baby was ripped away from her and she was sent back to be a housemaid.
Mm. Which again is... Oh, dreadful.
What you have to see is the illegitimate children, in this case at least, had it so much better than the mothers. Mm.
Coming back to Harriet, Mr. Knightley does make the point that even though her father is paying for her, he doesn't actually want anything at all to do with her, and yet that still makes her one of the lucky ones.
Well, a very lucky one. We're talking about a very, very tiny proportion of the girls that this happened to.
Yeah.
There is, of course, another Jane Austen novel that deals with illegitimacy, Sense and Sensibility. But here we've got quite a different situation. The girl involved is from the same class as the man who betrayed her and abandoned her, which is what happened with Colonel Brandon's cousin.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to finish with here is the vision I've had of a soft-hearted Colonel Brandon insisting that Willoughby's little son should come and visit Marianne's and his little girls in school holidays. You end up with a reverse situation of Edward and Fanny.
So, for pop culture this episode, we've now finished all of the faithful, in inverted commas, adaptations of Emma. So we're now moving into the modernisations, and I'm going to talk first of all about the 1995 film Clueless. And I think if you talk generally about modernisations of Jane Austen films, Clueless is probably the first one people are going to think of. It was written and directed by Amy Heckerling, and it is set in a Beverly Hills high school.
And nothing had gone before that was quite like that.
This is probably the first that I can think of the big film and TV modernisations of Jane Austen.
Yes.
Things like Bride and Prejudice came later.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is, following on from Clueless, in the 90s and the early 2000s, there are actually quite a lot of high school adaptations of classic literature. So just to give a couple of examples, in 1999 was 10 Things I Hate About You, which was another really popular one. It was based on The Taming of the Shrew. Also in 1999 was Cruel Intentions, based on Dangerous Liaisons. And She's All That, based on, depending on who you talk to, either Pygmalion or My Fair Lady. Then in 2001 was O, which was based on Othello. 2006 was She's the Man, based on Twelfth Night. And then in 2010 was Easy A, which is based on The Scarlet Letter. And that's just a handful of them. I know there were more.
And these are all set in high schools.
Yes. And so this definitely started a trend. This is one of the best known and best loved of that genre. And also, I would say, just of 90s high school teen movies, this also stands as one of the best known and best loved. So one of the reasons for setting Emma specifically in a high school is because high school culture is very socially stratified. So that maps nicely to Emma. And in fact, you have a scene where she's sort of pointing out the different cliques in the high school. And
how they rate.
Yeah, and how they rate in her estimation. So who's who? The Emma character is Cher Horowitz. And she is played by Alicia Silverstone, who does a lovely job. She lives with her father, who is an attorney. Mr. Knightley is Josh. He was her stepbrother. Their parents are not married anymore, but he still kind of hangs around a little bit.
Yeah.
So he is college age. Harriet is Ty, who is a girl from the East Coast who starts at this Beverly Hills High School and who Emma decides to basically give a makeover to. Mr. Elton is a character called Elton, who's a classmate of Emma and Ty. Mr. Martin is Travis, who's another classmate, but he is in one of these groups that Cher looks down her nose at. There is no Jane Fairfax, and the Frank Churchill equivalent is Christian, and the reason it's never going to work between Christian and Cher is that Christian is gay, but Cher doesn't work that out initially.
Oh, that's really quite a clever way of making him unavailable.
Yes, it works really well.
Yes.
Now, Mr. and Mrs. Weston, it's kind of interesting because you have two teachers at Cher's school, Miss Geist and Mr. Hall, and Cher tries to get the two of them together. And the film ends with their wedding. So you could say, okay, Miss Geist and Mr. Hall are Mr. and Mrs. Weston. Yes. But also, Miss Geist is sort of a bit disorganized and a bit talkative and lovely person into causes. So you could also say, well, there's a bit of Miss Bates in her. And equally, there are two characters not in Emma, which is Cher's best friend Dion and her boyfriend Murray. And Dion also has a little bit of the Mrs. Weston role because she is someone that Cher can talk to.
But she's another girl at the high school.
But she's another girl at the high school. There's not a direct parallel with the Westons. It's not as close a parallel as it is with some of the others.
Yes.
So just a couple of general observations I wanted to make about it. First of all, is that these students at this Beverly Hills High School, they are living an incredibly privileged life as is Emma, well, as is everyone in Jane Austen, which you've previously observed. Another thing, you know how, as we've been talking about Emma, you've been saying how one of the things you find funny about her is that she thinks she knows everything and in fact she doesn't have a clue.
Yeah.
Well, that is exactly the plot of Clueless, because when Ty first turns up at the school, Cher says, Ty was so adorably clueless. And so you think Clueless is talking about Ty. But then towards the end of the film, when Cher has had her big revelation about being in love with Josh, she says, I had been completely clueless. And that's what you get all the way through, her missing so much of what's happening. So exactly what you've been saying about Emma is clearly something Amy Heckerling saw and enjoyed in Emma and made such a feature of the film.
Yes.
Something you've often asked when I've been talking about the adaptations is how they deal with the mysteries. This one, honestly, doesn't really. For example, Christian, from the moment he turns up, it is so obvious that he is gay.
Yes.
And Cher and Dionne don't notice it. But I don't think it was meant to be a secret to anyone, and especially not to the audience.
Yes.
One thing I found is that so many of the touch points of Harriet's plot are in this movie.
So has she plucked the Harriet character out of a lower group?
Ty has come in and she's not already part of one of the groups. She is meant to be not quite as classy as yes. the rest of them.
And so she's going to catch Ty yeah. before Ty sort of gets absorbed in the wrong group.
Yes. Now, one of the first people Ty meets at the school is Travis. And she obviously really likes him, but Cher says, no, you do not want to associate with people who are going to get wasted at school. But, and again, this picks up with what you've been saying. It's clear that even when Cher is trying to make Ty interested in Elton, anytime Travis is around, Ty is looking at him and aware of him and clearly much more attracted to him than Cher necessarily picks up on. So you've got that happening. And then there's this party they go to. And Cher ends up being given a lift home by Elton. And it's in the car that he says, forget yeah. Ty, I'm interested in you. After that, Christian is going to take Cher to, I think it's a nightclub. And at that nightclub, you have this scene of Ty standing and no one's asking her to dance. And then Josh turns up and asks Ty to dance. And that then leads to Ty falling for Josh. And I think it's after that you have a scene, mapping to the Precious Treasures scene in the book, of Ty burning a thing that's associated with Elton. Then there's a scene where she's at the mall and she's sort of joking around with some guys, holding her over the edge over a barrier with a big drop, and she starts screaming. And Christian, who is, of course, the Frank Churchill equivalent, runs up and saves her. So
yes.
even though it doesn't have the same implications of Emma thinking Harriet is in love with Frank, it still has the event of Christian saving Ty. So as I said, point for point, there are so many clear, absolute connections with the Harriet story. I thought I'd finish, and by finish I mean spend probably at least as long again talking about just how close the characters are to their equivalents in the book. So starting with Cher. She is younger than Emma. She's 15 when the film begins and about 16 by the time it finishes. And she seems very young. She calls her father daddy all the time. Sometimes she can be a little bit whiny. She's more infantilized than Emma in the book is. Probably just because she presents as so much younger, it's kind of more forgivable, I find it. But something she has that I don't necessarily get from the Emma of the book is she has this joy in life. She has an exuberance.
Emma's trying every now and then to be sort of lady of the world rather than...
Yes, and Cher is just, she loves life, she's exuberant. She's actually not stupid, but she's also never really thinking terribly seriously about things, which is one of the issues Josh has with her.
Yeah.
What she gets crushed by, which I think is the equivalent of the Box Hill scene, is she fails her driving test. This is something she can't argue her way out of. So this is her moment of realization, and it's as a result of that she does some self-examination and then she realizes she's in love with Josh. So she is not the Emma of the book. But what I felt when I saw it and what I still feel is that I did get her in a way. I never got Emma of the book because she really is completely engaging in spite of her faults, and she is totally, totally well-meaning. In the mid-1990s, when you had this, and then you had Gwyneth Paltrow, and then you had Kate Beckinsale, if you asked me in 1997 who was my favourite Emma, I would probably have said Alicia Silverstone, because I just like her so much better than the others.
Yeah.
And I think that is an important aspect of this film. By making Emma younger, all of these faults are somehow just more forgivable, and Alicia Silverstone's performance is just so lovely that you kind of have to forgive her. Now, Emma's father, Mr. Horowitz, is completely different from Mr. Woodhouse. He's an attorney. He has big cases that he focuses on. But you have Cher telling him not to eat fast food, and the doctor says he must do this and mustn't do that, which is kind of a cute reference to Mr. Woodhouse.
Except the opposite, because Mr. Woodhouse worries all the time about what he's eating.
Yeah, so it's a reference, but the opposite. But what you do have that is very like Mr. Woodhouse is he's protective of Cher, and more importantly, he absolutely adores her. One thing about Ty as Harriet is this kind of subtle thing that Harriet gains confidence throughout the book, and in particular, by the end, she's saying, I hope I know better than to think of Mr. Martin. And, well, you get the same thing with Ty in that she continues initially to have this clear attraction for Travis, but then towards the end, she actually dismisses Travis completely and is quite cruel to him.
So Cher actually takes her at some point for being a real rival, does
Yes, it? And they do actually have a fight about it. And the fight culminates in one of the iconic lines of the film, which is when Ty says to Cher, you're just a virgin who can't drive. And I think that is the equivalent of Mr. Knightley's badly done Emma. That devastates her and makes her go through this very short period of self-reflection.
Yes.
The last one to talk about is Josh, Mr. Knightley. So he's probably somewhere between 18 and 20, which does mean that having a relationship with a 16-year-old, it has a slightly ick factor, but in the same way that Emma and Mr. Knightley has a slightly ick factor. So whether that was intentional or not, I don't know. He's into causes. He's into serious reading. Sometimes he's a bit of a caricature. At one point, Cher says to him, you think I'm just a ditz with a credit card. But you get the friendship between them and the banter between them. And you do get that they've got this relationship that's been built up from when they were stepbrother and sister. They understand each other. They can laugh at each other. They can tease each other. And then that transitions over into him kind of noticing her and her noticing him. So I just feel it is a really clever adaptation of Emma to a modern setting. There are so many clear touch points to the book, but that work. They don't feel strained. She didn't feel obliged to put everything in, which again, I think is good. Yeah, the characters' personalities aren't exactly the same, but you can see the connection. There are some aspects of it that are maybe a little bit 1990s now, but it is still an enjoyable film to watch, and it works. I just think as a clever, smart, modern adaptation of Emma, it works so well, and it is a really fun movie. So that was Clueless. On our original schedule, I had planned next time to talk about Aisha, the Bollywood version of Emma. But I have discovered that there appears to be absolutely no streaming service in Australia that it's available on, and I can't find it on DVD that has English subtitles. And so next time, I'm going to go straight into the first of the two web series, Emma Approved. You've been listening to the Reading Jane Austen podcast with me, Harriet.
And me, Ellen. In our next episode, we'll be looking at chapters 32 to 36 of Emma.
The structure of this podcast was inspired by Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Our music is Creative Commons performances of pieces Jane Austen might have listened to.
You can find us on Facebook at Reading Jane Austen and our website, readingjaneausten.com.
We also now have an Instagram account, reading_Jane_Austen, because Reading Jane Austen without the underscores was already taken. You can email us at readingjaneausten.com or rate and review us in your podcast app. We hope you'll join us next time.